For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure I have a point in this somewhere, but I have appreciated this chance to spend a few minutes sitting Zazen. You know, we're in the middle now of our practice commitment period, and part of that, for most of us, is involved committing to do a little more Zazen than usual, meet with the teacher more often than usual, meet with other members of the Sangha more often than usual, and to do some extra study of the Lotus Sutra. That last has been a little challenging for some of us, I think. I've really appreciated the chance to sit more Zazen than usual. It's, you know, it's something that I always enjoy trying to speak about because it's so challenging. It's, and that's a little bit odd because Zazen is just really a continuation of our ordinary life on the cushion. The way we live our life ordinarily is really how we experience sitting on the cushion. And it's interesting that how tough people tend to make Zazen sound. And I think that's completely orthodox Buddhism, that a great deal of our experience involves being very caught up in our thoughts and feelings, and especially you know, our reactions of attachment and aversion. We tend to be a little abstracted from our life and what we're doing from moment to moment. And when that happens, I think we almost always slip into patterns of thinking and feeling that are very much caught up in neediness and threat. And that carries over onto the cushion as well, I think. We end up sitting with those thoughts worrying about what we would like to have happen and what bad thing happened at work and what's going to happen tomorrow or how angry we are at a spouse or sister or child, all of those things. And then we wake up, we sort of cut through that and are at rest. You know, and in particular, something that happens is we cut ourselves off from the world when we're caught up in that sort of attachment and aversion, that neediness and sense of threat, that we want something, we need something, something's going to bad's going to happen to us, something's going to be taken away from us. And we're separated from everything. Everything in our life that happens and the people around us somehow just don't measure up because they don't meet what we hoped for or would expect. And that's what makes it so wonderful, those frequent moments when we wake up, we remember where we are, and we're right here, not caught up in that. Even if we can still feel those emotions and are aware of those thoughts, we're not caught up in them, and we find ourselves right here in the middle of this. We are part of this. That's really, I think, the joy of Zazen. And it's something that I don't think gets spoken about or talked about very much, but that is the moment of awakening, awakened activity, which is really the hallmark of our lineage. And at that moment, in that awakened activity, we experience the awakening of the Buddhas and our ancestors. It's very hard to write about. And so a lot of Buddhist scriptures are, a lot of Buddhist writing is couched in negatives, you know, talking about emptiness, you know, it's there are no forms, no sensations, no consciousness, no things, and so on. Or even in more classic Buddhism, everything is broken down into parts so that you, to try to help you break through the identification with that sense of solid self and solid things that end up in your feeling so separated and from them. But there are other approaches as well that try to talk about thusness and the fullness of existence and the fullness of life without being caught up in describing the world as a collection of fixed pieces and blocks and things. And Zen koans, or our traditional teaching stories, are very often all about that. But I think the Lotus Sutra is as well. And perhaps a more, try to come up with a good word for it, I don't want to say radical, but certainly flamboyant way than most koans. You know, for our practice period, we're focusing on four chapters. One from the first section of the Lotus Sutra, chapter 2, about skillful means, and then two from the second section, which are part of a section that's called The Assembly in the Air, chapters 11, 15, and 16, about the treasure stupa, the bodhisattva springing from the earth, and the inconceivable lifespan of the Buddha. And I wanted to focus on chapter 11, the treasure stupa story, as an example of a scripture that tries to describe that joy of awakening here and now to the world, finding yourself in this world that isn't this world that doesn't measure up, but it's a world of joy and precious, and that's precious. You know, the first part in the way that the chapter, the treasure stupa, is set up is that the Buddha is preaching to an incalculable number of humans and other beings on the Vulture Peak Mountain, and he's told them sort of several very, very surprising things that they haven't heard before, and that is that, you know, Buddhas come on this earth not to save themselves, but they're born for the sole purpose of bringing other beings to awakening and becoming Buddhas. And he also reveals to everyone there that they too are going to be Buddhas. And when he finishes his explanation in chapter 2 and the following chapters, the world suddenly begins to be transformed as the Buddha, let's say, perhaps grants to all of the bodhisattvas on Vulture Peak a glimpse of this world as the Buddha sees it, as a Buddha field. You know, he has just finished when right out of the earth, right here, this world, a gigantic, elaborate stupa, we'll tell the story one more time, springs up right in front of the Buddha and lifts up into the air, and it's enormous. It's 1,500 miles high, it's 750 miles across. At the bottom, it's covered with jewels and other precious substances. It's fragrant. It's elaborately carved with all sorts of niches and decorations in it. And as soon as it springs up, you hear a voice saying, What does he say? He goes, well done, you hear a voice, well done, world-honored Shakyamuni, for the sake of the great assembly, you are able to teach the wonderful Dharma Flower Sutra of great impartial wisdom, the Dharma by which Bodhisattvas are taught, and which Buddhas protect and keep in mind. It is just as you say, world-honored Shakyamuni, all that you say is true. Well, everyone, when they see this great miraculous appearance of the stupa, is filled with joy, and all of the creatures of the world start providing offerings. The gods drop mandarava flowers from out of the sky, and all of the animals and other divinities come, and they also provide offerings too. And sort of one of the key figures steps forward to speak to Shakyamuni. I think he's great delight in preaching, and I tend to think of him more as Pushy Bodhisattva, because he steps up and says, you know, what is this about, Shakyamuni? And Shakyamuni explains to him that this is the stupa of a very ancient Buddha from inconceivable numbers of eons ago, abundant treasures, who, when he was a bodhisattva, promised that when he became a Buddha, every time the Lotus Sutra was being preached, he would come to praise the Buddha's teaching the Lotus Sutra and listen to the Lotus Sutra. So there's this ancient Buddha. He's dead. He's already been extinguished, but the sound of the Lotus Sutra, he himself has become reanimated. If he's not fully alive, at least he's animated by hearing the Lotus Sutra. Pushy Bodhisattva, great delight in preaching Bodhisattva, says, well, I would really like to see this Buddha, this embodiment of awakening. How can we do that? And the Buddha says, well, if someone wants to see the body of abundant treasures, then the Buddha who is teaching the Lotus Sutra at that point must summon all of the Buddhas from throughout the cosmos who are the embodiment of this Buddha, and have them come and make offerings to abundant treasures, and then everyone will be able to see them. So, great delight in preaching, it takes the next step and says, well, okay, good, I want to see these other Buddhas too. This has been sort of a surprise, yes? They're used to the idea that there's only one Buddha at a time during any age, and they've already seen abundant treasures appear in a stupa and speak to them, and now there's this news that there are incalculable Buddhas embodying Shakyamuni Buddha throughout the cosmos. So he wants to see, and Shakyamuni says yes, and from between his eyebrows he emits a blinding white light that illumines the entire cosmos, and everyone on Vulture Peak can see that there once again are incalculable numbers of Buddhas who are teaching the Lotus Sutra, and they're surrounded by far more incalculable numbers of bodhisattvas that they're teaching. So when the light shines on them, the Buddhas turn to their assemblies and say, all right, it's time to go to Shakyamuni Buddha's world to make offerings to abundant treasures. And at that moment, the transformation of the world that's already started with the emergence of the stupa with abundant treasures in it really goes crazy, and the world starts to really transform itself into this precious, beautiful world in which the ground is covered with lapis. It's full of gigantic jeweled trees with enormous gold statues of lions. The air is full of mandarava, beautiful mandarava flowers that smell wonderful. There's incense. And strangely, at the same time, all the divisions within the world disappear because suddenly there are no longer any towns or rivers or mountains or forests or any borders or enclosures that might break up the earth and prevent people from moving around, that might separate people from each other. And at the same time, suddenly the only people who are in this world are bodhisattvas. So that having happened, then all of the Buddhas from the distant lands, distant worlds, and their attendants start arriving, and they are keep coming and coming and coming, and the Buddha starts to purify the entire world. And then there are too many. They can't all fit, so he has to purify another world, and they get, those worlds also get, the ground gets covered with lapis, and there are the large jeweled trees with the gold lions, and the air is full of mandarava flowers and incense and so on, and then he has to do it again. And then all of the Buddhas who've come to visit and to see abundant treasure sit on their giant lion seats and send their bodhisattvas to make offerings to the Buddha and to abundant treasures. And so they arrive and make their offerings, and at that point the requirement for seeing abundant treasures has been fulfilled. So Shakyamuni Buddha lifts up into the air and opens the stupa with a loud noise, and there is Abundant Treasures, who is alive. And Abundant Treasures says, again says, "Well done, well done, sit with me." And so the Buddha sits next to Abundant Treasures. And in that moment, you know, at that point, the world has really been completely transformed. So there's a continuity of the awakening in the world from the past to the present, and the entire cosmos and the worlds that have been separated from our world have all dissolved as this world has been changed into one gigantic Buddha field. And that's followed finally by the bodhisattvas on Vulture Peak saying, "Well, the Buddhas over there in those other lands who sent their attendants are up on their big lion seats, and they can see you and Abundant Treasures, but we can't. So we would like to," and Shakyamuni lifts them up into the air so that they can see the two Buddhas sitting in the stupa to get a clear view of this embodiment of awakening and to see the entire world from this elevated position. And at that point, Shakyamuni Buddha, since they have now had this great vision of the world with all its divisions separated, it's now the world where at least time and space are porous, you would have to say, and the world has become precious. And the world is absolutely full of awakening beings and awakened beings. The Buddha turns to them all and says, "Who was able to teach the wonderful Dharma Flower Sutra everywhere throughout this world? Now indeed is the time. Before long, the Tathagata will enter Nirvana, so that it will last forever. The Buddha wants to entrust this wonderful Dharma Flower Sutra to someone." So the challenge, he makes this challenge to the bodhisattvas there on Vulture Peak. Who will teach the Lotus Sutra? Who will do the Buddha work? Who will embody the Dharma now? And the answer is clearly, we will. That's the challenge that we face as well. I don't want to go on at too great length, but what I thought I would do is just finish by reading a poem, Hakuin's Song of Zazen, the Zazenwasan. And while Hakuin is the ancestor of all modern lineages of Japanese Rinzai Zen, I think this poem really shows us how much we share with other schools of Zen. And I wanted to read this because I feel like it's not only it not only expressly refers to the Lotus Sutra, but I think it very much captures the message of the treasure stupa story in the Lotus Sutra. So I wanted to read that. From the beginning, all beings are Buddha. Like water and ice, without water, no ice. Outside of us, no Buddhas. How near the truth, yet how far we seek. Like one in water crying, I thirst. Like the son of a rich man wandering poor on this earth, we endlessly circle the six worlds. The cause of our sorrow is ego delusion. From dark path to dark path, we've wandered in darkness. How can we be freed from the wheel of samsara? The gateway to freedom is Zazen Samadhi. Beyond exaltation, beyond all our praises, the pure Mahayana. Observing the precepts, repentance and giving, the countless good deeds and the way of right living all come from Zazen. Thus one true Samadhi extinguishes evils. It purifies karma, dissolving obstructions. Then where are the dark paths to lead us astray? The pure lotus land is not far away. Hearing this truth, heart humble and grateful, to praise and embrace it, to practice its wisdom, brings unending blessings, brings mountains of merit. And if we turn inward and prove our true nature, that true self is no self, our own self is no self, we go beyond ego and past clever words, then the gate to the oneness of cause and effect is thrown open. Not two and not three, straight ahead runs the way. Our form now being no form, in going and returning, we never leave home. Our thought now being no thought, our dancing and songs are the voice of the Dharma. How vast is the heaven of boundless samadhi. How bright and transparent the moonlight of wisdom. What is there outside us? What is there we lack? Nirvana is openly shown to our eyes. This earth where we stand is the pure lotus land. And this very body, the body of Buddha. So, I think that's a work of genius. So I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you. Does anyone have anything they would like to say about the Song of Zazen or Chapter 11 of the Lotus Sutra? You know, it is a celebration of awakening, and that's not something we talk about all that much, I don't think.
No, I think that that's another thing that really struck me. I think that it's something that's sort of unbelievable how often I miss that sort of essential element of that. I think that always been maybe because like pleasure has some of the negative contents. Effort towards like purity or something, you know, some kind of like
No, I think that's fair, and I think it's interesting how many times in the Lotus Sutra the text refers to the joy felt by the bodhisattvas at the message that the Buddha is preaching. And that's just not something we see too much. I mean, it's an unfair image, but Buddhism certainly sometimes has a sort of gloomy image, right? So this is a real counterweight to that. Yes, Hakusho.
The Zen tradition is full of this language of this three bodies, the body of the Buddha, and talking about the Lotus Sutra as a celebration of awakening. And when that's not our experience, can we still celebrate? And if so, how?
You know, I think that's the downside of that kind of message, trying to capture with imagery and affirmative statements and metaphor what awakening is like. We sort of expect the ability to, that when we wake up to and wake up from our suffering, that we're going to feel very happy, that the opposite of suffering is pleasure. But, you know, it's... I think the opposite of dukkha is sukha, but sukha is not necessarily... It's not pleasure, it's not necessarily happiness or joy, but it's the polar opposite of suffering and anxiety and unease. But this, I think, so that's the problem, that there is release and freedom in awakening to our own suffering and delusion. But it doesn't always feel like joy.
I heard a story, and it was, I'm not even going to be able to tell you the story. It was somebody who had been a refugee, and I had the feeling, because I, you know, I don't know what came before. But I knew that this person had been through an awful lot and had lost family members and had really been through a great deal of trial because of the refugee situation. And he was talking to some interviewer, and he said to the interviewer, "I wake up every morning determined to be happy." And I thought that was so interesting, that no matter what is going on, that you can resolve that you are going to be happy. And you are not going to dwell on all of the bad stuff. And you are going to, you know, enjoy, you know, value and look at your life as something precious and that you want it. And it's, and that you're going to be happy that day. I really thought that was interesting, and it's sort of like you open your eyes and you see a stupa that is 10,000 feet high and covered with jewels, and this is the world that you are going to live in that day.
I guess I've always liked something that Steve Stuckey said he did every morning when he woke up, which was to, before he got up, he would just think, "I'm so grateful." Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure was very hard to do toward the end of his life, but it was something he tried to do.
Yeah.
say, I love to be focused on the word celebration. Not exactly happiness, it's just celebration is an act, it's like a ritual. So Zazen acts as celebration, and it doesn't even have to be a celebration of something else, it's just who we are. Something about that. Sorry.
That was a wonderful poem. Thank you for sharing that with us. It's definitely going up on my fridge. But I wanted to kind of relate to what you... I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Dan.
And Hakusho kind of brought up, you know, just the fact that this is kind of what we, you know, what we are here to embody. But one of the things that you mentioned at the beginning is how our own personal suffering kind of separates us. But one of the things that I was wondering is, you know, how do we, you know, kind of acknowledge both our own personal pain and historical pain without just thinking, oh, well, it's going to evaporate into the air and I'm not going to suffer, but still not let the kind of experiences that separate us and kind of wrap us in ego.
I think that we have to face pain, and in facing it and facing our own delusion, we loosen the hold it has on us. It doesn't necessarily evaporate, but the hold is loosened and we're freer to act without being swallowed up by it. I think that's my experience.
I have a comment that I think it actually connects with a lot of people have been saying with what you were saying in your relation to the story. I mean, the Lotus Sutra really is pretty, when we say the word radical too much, but it really is a radical thing. And so, you know, it has this language, and we talk about the transformation of, you know, this world, you know, in your way you related, you talk about it was transformed into lapis lazuli, Buddhas everywhere, and all that kind of thing. And that's a way of putting it, but at the same time, it seems like what it's really going for is like that world that we're talking about as transformed is this very world and the very way we experience it, which includes all of these, you know, personal and historical karmic injuries, and still there's somehow this possibility that this refugee that you spoke of embodied or expressed of like, you know, waking up to, you know, this word used for preciousness, you know, preciousness of human life, at all life. So, I don't know. I just thank you for your talk. I too really.
Thank you. Well, and
we need to have a Douglas story hour. You can read this. Stories of the Lotus Sutra.
Well, I think part of the point of the story, right, is that this is not, these are still bodhisattvas working their way toward Buddhahood. And after the assembly in the air, they'll be back on ordinary vulture paint, and they'll have to sweep up the confetti and the flowers and all the rest of it. But they're now they know.
Yeah,
and they can find that preciousness there.
I mean, I'm reminded of the way Dogen puts it, which is not, you know, waking up from dukkha or waking up from delusion, waking up from all these things, but waking up in them.
Yeah.
It's not like this gets to this thing you're talking about, it's like, you know, in some metric, sukha and dukkha, are opposites, but they don't cancel each other. It's a different, more subtle kind of relationship, right?
Yeah.
That's waking up. Right? Where we really are in, you know, sometimes seeming thing we experience.
Yeah.
They're even there.
Thank you so much for bringing this poem. I know it by heart, and I used to say it all the time, and the last four lines really what is there outside us? What is there we lack? Nirvana is openly shown to our eyes. This earth where we stand is not sure of us, this very body. It's so helpful and so clear and so complete for me. And it was a really interesting connection between the story of the hyperbole of the images.
You know, Hakuin, as a younger man, had read the Lotus Sutra and was very unimpressed. And as he got older, I think he was reading the first three chapters and just was struck by how wonderful the sutra was. And you can tell, I mean, the story is like the son of a rich man wandering poor on the earth. That's the story, is the parable of the rich man's son from the Lotus Sutra that he's talking about.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was a very rich experience of the celebration of the Sutra Flow, closed by celebrating the 4 points of
beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusion.